All rise in the courtroom and to those listening on stream, for the dishonorable badger is entering the scene. Apparently doing this as a day job simply was not enough, so let your jaws drop to the floor, 'cause we can't make this stuff up. Welcome back to the Legal Funhouse. We put the fun in dysfunctional. It's crazy in the Legal Funhouse, but weirdly educational. But every single one is remarkably true. One of them went to law school and is more than qualified to talk about the strangest cases from the strangest people alive. And the friend that he brought along barely passed eighth grade, whose legal experience lies within parking in the fire lane. Welcome back to the Legal Funhouse. We're just as confused as you. It's finally time for the Legal Funhouse, and without further ado, every single one is remarkably true. It's Boozy's Legal Funhouse. It's Boozy's Legal Funhouse. It's Boozy's Legal Funhouse. It's Boozy's Legal Funhouse.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Boozy's Legal Funhouse. I am your host, the Boozy Badger, and with me, as always, is our certified legal layman, Alkali. Say hi, Alkali.
Hello, everyone.
I love that's the first time we've ever had applause. Like, normally by this point, like, the listeners at home are going to be so confused, because normally at this point, one of our audio has fucked up.
Every time.
And we stop the recording to re-record the part where the audio has fucked up. And then I go, you know what? Fuck it. It's staying in.
Genuinely, one of our favorite tech errors that we have. Thank God this one can be long-winded. I had just said something and I noticed my audio cut out at the end of a sentence. So they took over. I was behind an avatar. I was running around my studio trying to find replacement microphones and headsets. Well, you went, listen to you like, I have maybe like 5 minutes. Thank God he just keeps talking.
So, if this is your first time listening or attending, Boozy's Legal Funhouse is an educational, informational, and hopefully entertaining podcast about the law and basic legal principles. It is not legal advice. I am a lawyer. I am not your lawyer. And Alkali is definitely not a lawyer. For the love of God, please stop asking Alkali for legal advice.
Never.
It's funnier that way, though.
This has happened several times now where Alkali's somewhere and somebody says, oh, he's on the law podcast, and they start asking him questions, and I'm going, they obviously have not listened to the law podcast.
I got a message Thursday. Desperately need your help, Alkali. Oh, God, what's up? How much booze am I legally allowed to carry onto a plane?
Okay, you know what? No, fair. You may actually know the answer to that one.
Boozy, I have never carried booze onto a plane other than inside me.
That prison pocket comes in handy.
Oh. Mind they don't pick your pocket.
The way that you get legal advice or I become your lawyer is... you call me, you make an appointment, you sit down, you come into my office, you tell me your issue. I say, I can help with that. You sign an engagement letter and pay a retainer of my choosing. You can't just PayPal me a buck and say I'm your attorney. It doesn't work that way. At least you could do all those things if I was in private practice, but I'm not in private practice anymore, so you can't fucking hire me.
You love that so much.
Yes. Yes, I do. The way that you actually get legal advice is you go to an attorney licensed in your jurisdiction. What we are going to talk about today in terms of legal things are general legal things. Each law is a little different in every state. You need a lawyer who knows your state's laws. Please, for the love of God, do not tell a judge, a fat guy who acts like a cartoon badger on the internet told me this. It will not work out in your favor.
I don't know. I'm a judge. It might work out for me.
The second rule, and this is for the people listening at home, if things get fucked up, if the audio levels are too loud, if something cuts off, if the audience says something about fitting things in their asshole, it stays in. I hate
phrasing! Boozy, that was not the right way to say that.
It was for me. I hate editing. We do this shit in one take. There is an episode that will never be released because for 5 solid minutes, Alkali's audio cut out, and I do not have it in me to find the portion of the recording where that occurs and cut it out and edit it. I just fucking don't. So one take, we're doing it live, okay? Wonderful. As long as we're all on the same page before we begin, as always, we have some wonderful Patreon supporters of the show that can are over at Lawyers and Liquor at patreon.com/lawyersandliquor. So at our $5 level above, a special thank you to Ashtarosh, Jack of All Korgs, Tezcat Magic, Jag Dozer, Trash Panda, Mama T, Uncle Kage, David Hunter, Evelyn Klein, Lufus the Raccoon, Netherlinks, Pandemonium, Aaron Williams, Alkali Anonymous, Amethyst, Andy, Beaton, Buddy, Good Boy, CC Otter, Chroma Hydra, Dragor, Eddie the Weather Fox, Emily Wyke, Brood, Floofy Foxers, Ghost Goat, Grace Jane Gollinger, Head Foxen, Jason Knight, Julie Esslinger, Jess James Lack, Leon Dashwood, Lorraine Poirier, Mark Whipple, Michael Blocker. Mark Whipple right over there in the front row. Nikolai, Otto Poom, Petrov, Neutrino, Red Fox, Rune Dog, Scuba Fox, Zarathan, Silver, Skyre, Tiny Voices, Tyron, Ziggy Bull, and Zigzy Fox. Thank you all so much. And as always, if you want to be one of those wonderful people, you can go to patreon.com/lawyersandliquor. That said, Alkali, we start the show the same way every time.
Nude.
I'm going to pretend that you said news.
Oh, yeah. No, that's, it's the Chicago accent.
Yeah. That's, we're not at home, asshole.
This is Fur Squared. This is my home. And if you'll excuse me, it's time for the news.
So I actually had a number of legal news stories that we were going to go over. However, I found one that I think really needs to be discussed in depth so the other two can fuck off into the ether somewhere. In Pennsylvania, there is the Magistrates Court. And the Magistrates Court is like a district court. They're an elected lay judiciary. They can be lawyers. They don't have to be lawyers. It's like the lowest level of court in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And in Dauphin County, Pennsylvania, where Harrisburg, the state capital, is, there is a magistrate judge who has been on the bench since 2015. Her name is Sonia McKnight. Right?
Okay.
And Sonia McKnight is a very respected jurist who just got bailed out of prison.
Always good on your, I don't know, resume? I don't know how to become a judge.
Let me ask, why do you think Judge McKnight was in the Dauphin County prison?
AI.
No.
Every other time it's AI.
Not this time.
Not this time.
Not
okay.
This time.
So this is a judge who ended up in prison.
Yep.
I'm going to say those robes were so nice they were also watching the news and then some northern indecent exposure.
Attempted murder.
Oh. I was close.
Judge McKnight, who is currently under suspension for attempted murder, was arrested after
murdering.
Well, okay. To be fair to Judge McKnight. All right. Judge McKnight has had a hard time with relationships and was in a relationship for about a year with a gentleman named Michael McCoy. And they lived
the real Michael McCoy.
The real Michael McCoy. They lived together during their relationship, and after about a year, Mike decides that he's not feeling it anymore, so they break up, right?
Okay.
And Mike's like, you know, Sonia, Your Honor. I imagine that he calls her Your Honor around the house. If I'm a judge, you're calling me Your Honor all the goddamn time. Like, you know, oh, you taking a shit, Your Honor? Yes, I am.
QM, I feel so bad for you sometimes.
Oh, Your Honor. Oh, Your Honor. Anyways.
QM, I'm so jealous of you sometimes.
You're learning a lot about my bedroom proclivities right now.
Mind they don't pick your pocket.
Why is there vodka in there?
I was on a plane. Okay, continue.
So Judge McKnight and Mr. McCoy have ended their relationship. Mike McCoy is, Your Honor, you need to move out. We it's my house. We're not in a relationship. You need to move out. And Judge McKnight, who the magistrates, by the way, handle evictions in Pennsylvania, like that's the court for landlord-tenant stuff, says, no. Which has to be terrifying. Like, if you have a judge living with you and you're like, hey, I need you to move out. And they're like, fucking file a lawsuit against me. Because, and by the way, it gets even better because the magistrate judges in Pennsylvania, not like countywide, there's magisterial districts, right? And the judge for a magisterial district has to live in the district. So she's like, no, I'm not. You can't make me move out. Why? Because you have to file a lawsuit in my district.
That's a power play. Okay.
Now, you can wonder a lot about why Judge McKnight's relationship with Mr. McCoy broke down. Yeah. Until you hear about why Judge McKnight was in prison for attempted murder. Because one night, Michael McCoy went to bed. Right?
Oh, no.
And then he woke up.
That's good.
With a gunshot wound to his face.
Whoa. Face?
Face.
Face.
And Judge McKnight standing over his bed going, what did you do? However did this happen? Calls 911 like he's done something to himself. And he's like, I don't want to kill myself. And the cops are, do you remember what happened? He's like, no, why? I've been shot in the head.
Oh, my God.
So Judge McKnight is questioned by the police, right?
Okay.
And they do a gun swab, and they find gunshot residue on her hand, and I can only imagine that she's like, well, how did that get there? Right? And the DA in Dauphin County said, you know, this is a judge. We have cases in front of her. We can't handle this. They handed it over to the Attorney General's office. The Attorney General's office investigated and said, yeah, we're really sure that Judge McKnight shot her ex-boyfriend in the face and then tried to make it sound like he did it to himself. That is, by the way, McKnight's defense, is he did it to himself. He must have, you know, he was drinking that night. He must have been depressed. He shot himself, okay? So it's really up in the air. But Judge McKnight was in the Dauphin County Prison on a $300,000 bond that has now been posted. She is out. She is still suspended, though. She's still suspended. That's after her last suspension.
Oh, dear God. Who did she murder that time?
Oh, she didn't murder anybody that time. No.
I don't like where this is going.
Judge McKnight has a son.
Oh, no.
Oh?
And Judge McKnight's son got pulled over by the Harrisburg, Pennsylvania police.
Oh.
And they found a lot of drugs in the car. And I'm just going to describe how this was back in like 2020, all right? So I'm just going to describe how this happened. Is they say the dash cam video shows the stop and the search and the arrest and then Judge McKnight pulling up to the scene and having a conversation with the audio off with the police officer. And then Judge McKnight's son was let back into the car to drive away.
Oh.
So Judge McKnight was criminally charged with interfering with a police investigation. Yeah. She was acquitted, by the way. the courts, like the judges and the Court of Common Pleas, which is the next higher court that supervises all the magistrates' court, were like, yeah, but the video doesn't show what she said. So, like, she's acquitted. And then the Judicial Conduct Board was, okay, she's acquitted, but she's also suspended for 200 days. And now she's on probation. All right. So you think Judge McKnight, she came back from suspension, then she shot her boyfriend, and she went back on suspension, right?
Right.
No, she was already suspended when she shot her boyfriend.
Allegedly, you got to say it lightly.
Yeah, she was already suspended because she had been, I love it, one of the charges is time theft. The judge was stealing time, like not appearing for cases for no reason. That's got to be something. So she was already suspended when she allegedly shot her boyfriend. I have to keep saying allegedly because she hasn't been convicted of anything. Okay? And you would honestly, like that's the end of it. Like it sounds like a big thing, right?
Yeah.
And maybe her boyfriend did shoot himself.
Maybe, in a different universe, sure.
Maybe he did. Now, Judge McKnight does have a son. He's obviously an adult son, right?
That story changes dramatically if he's not.
So you may ask, if Judge McKnight has an adult son, what happened to her ex-husband, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Was he shot in the face?
No.
Where was he shot?
She shot him in the dick. I don't even have to say allegedly for that one because she's like, yes, I did that.
You know, I'm starting to understand why you told me I wasn't that bad of a judge at Anthrocon. Thank you, man. Thank you.
Now, she shot her husband in the dick in 2019. I want to reiterate, Judge McKnight was elected to the bench in 2015. She's been a judge throughout this entire time. And some of you are like, how does she keep getting reelected, right? You know, because Judge Dick Shooter may not be that great on the ballot. First, judges are elected to a 10-year term, so she's never come up for re-election.
Oh.
Second, Judge McKnight actually, they didn't charge that one. An investigation determined it was self-defense.
Against his dick?
From her ex-husband. Now, could it have been? Yes, it was a very contentious end of the marriage. I mean, like the court records show that she got PFAs against him, but then the PFAs would be modified, and they sniped back and forth at each other. But let me just tell you the facts surrounding the dick shooting. And you can judge it for yourself as to whether or not it was self-defense at that point, okay?
Absolutely.
So they're separated. They've been separated for a year. Very contentious, arguing back and forth.
Okay.
All right? She has a PFA, a protection from abuse order, against him. She goes to court and gets it modified to allow for them to have peaceful contact with each other. Right?
Like dick shootings, okay.
He says, hey, I'm going to go to North Carolina for a while. She doesn't like the idea of him going to North Carolina, but okay, they're separated. They're in the process of getting a divorce.
Okay.
All right? She calls him and says, before you leave, could you come over and help me move some furniture? He says, sure, comes over. Her account is that he had moved the furniture and she was taking his car to the store to buy some food for them. He did not like the idea she was going to the store, so he tried to pull her out of the car while screaming at her, and that's when the dick shooting occurred. His account is he came over, moved one chair, and then she said, you're not going to North Carolina, and jumped in his car, refusing to get out to prevent him from leaving. And when he grabbed her arm to try to move her out of the car, she shot him in the dick. So, the takeaway, draw your own conclusion as to what happened to Mr. McCoy. I'm just saying that Judge McKnight shot her ex-husband in the dick. She wasn't criminally convicted, but the Judicial Conduct Board found it was more likely than not she tried to get her son off on drug charges using her office. She was suspended by the Judicial Conduct Board for, I mean, they're like, she stole from the office and just didn't show up for court hearings. And then when her last boyfriend broke up with her and told her to move out, he went to bed one night and woke up with a gunshot to his head.
I'm starting to notice her solution to problems seems to involve a 2 out of 3 chance of gun. So I don't think I like her very much.
Like, you know what? Here's the thing is I said earlier, you're like, did she shoot him in the head too? And I'm like, no, she shot him in the dick. But now that I'm thinking about it, yes, technically. Yeah, good old Judge Headshot McKnight there. So that, I want to follow, I use that one because we have a bad judge in that story, right?
Right.
Okay. And we have a bad woman judge in that story.
Okay.
Okay. So the story today, our legal case for today, the thing we are going to discuss is not really a legal precedent. There's got to be a bit there and things we've talked about in the past on how the law is structured, but it's more about legal history.
Fun. All
because right. I want to tell you about Lavinia Goodall. Lavinia Goodall was the first female lawyer in the state of Wisconsin.
Oh, that's cool.
And she was the first female lawyer to be admitted to practice before the Wisconsin Supreme Court.
Very cool. Yeah. All right. Did she shoot someone?
No.
Excellent. The story's getting better.
I just want to be clear. I'm not sure how she didn't shoot someone because I would have shot the motherfucker.
This is going to be fun.
So Lavinia Goodall is born in 1858 in Utica, New York. Her father is William Goodall. He's a noted abolitionist. He publishes an abolitionist newspaper. Lavinia, growing up, was always interested in the law. After the equivalent of high school, she's telling people, I would like to study law, but there's so many bars to someone of my gender practicing the law. So instead, she goes into the newspaper business. She's writing for her father's paper. She's acting as an editor for Weekly. She's writing pieces for equal rights and against slavery. She is writing pieces, I said 1858, but I think I'm actually wrong when she was born. She was born 1839. 1858 was something else in the story.
Okay.
So that's actually when she, 1858, that's where I got that. She wrote a letter to her sister saying, I would like to practice law, but there's so many bars in the way. She's a noted abolitionist, very well known, noted in pushing for equality for women in New York and in Wisconsin, in temperance. She didn't like drinking.
Okay.
She didn't think people should drink. Probably the only thing I don't like about Lavinia Goodall. Okay? Like, you know, slavery's bad. Yes, Lavinia. Women should have equal rights. Yes, Lavinia. Drinking's bad. Fuck you. Just, you had me up until, well, I guess if you're wrong about that, let's look at the other things. God damn it. No, I am not that fucking petty. So, in the 1970s, her parents moved to Wisconsin. And as was typical. Yes. No, in the 1970s, her 200-year-old parents moved to Wisconsin. Yes, thank you for catching that, Leafy. Now that is on tape for everyone. You could have just let me keep fucking going. Nobody would have picked it up except you. You detail-oriented prick. Anyways, the 1870s...
Okay, hold on. Credit where it's due. When's the last time somebody with the name Leafy Greens was detail-oriented? I can barely remember where I keep my grinder half the time. Well done, Leafy. Well done.
So it's after the Civil War, 1871. Her parents decide they're going to move to Janesville, Wisconsin. All right. And as was typical for young ladies of that era, Lavinia followed her family. She was an unmarried woman of that era. She follows her family. She moves to Wisconsin as well. When she moves to Wisconsin, she decides, I'm going to be a lawyer. She finds an attorney, A.A. Jackson, and she studies law under that. She goes into the circuit court, and she's watching proceedings in the circuit court in Wisconsin. However, in that time period, if you didn't go to a law school and you read law, you had to be tutored by an attorney. You had to serve as an apprentice. And no lawyer in Wisconsin would take her on as an apprentice. Just none of them. They're like, a woman in a law office, fetch me coffee. write things out.
A do witch! This.
But Lavinia, in A.A. Jackson's office, is not only reading law. What she's doing, she's hired as a copyist, which is like the 1870s Xerox machine.
Oh.
Like, that's what it was. A copyist would take these things and then rewrite them to make copies. Okay? So she's the Xerox machine in A.A. Jackson's law office. But he has a law library, which was very common, a room just full of law books and cases. And in her off time, on her breaks, her lunch, off time that she's in the office, all the downtime she had, she's in the law library reading the law, reading the cases, educating herself.
That's actually really cool.
Finally, in 1874, she convinces an attorney named Pliny Norcross, who's a local Wisconsin attorney and a hero of the Civil War, to let her tutor under him. And Pliny is apparently just a great guy. Like, he shows up all over Wisconsin history. Like, he served in the legislature. He was a big wheel in the 1870s. He takes Lavinia as his apprentice. And in 1874, he goes, "You already know what you need to know, so I am going to stand at the bar for you." Standing at the bar is how attorneys would say to the court, "It's time for my apprentice to become a lawyer." And when you stood at the bar, you sponsored somebody's application to the bar, and you go in front of whatever judicial body or whatever board of examiners the state had been set up, and that person would question you and decide whether or not you had the requisite fitness to practice law. Okay? That was one of two paths. And this is important, because the second path was if you went to the University of Wisconsin's law school, they just automatically gave you a bar license. You were automatically admitted to practice. Because you had gone to a law school, you were assumed to have that knowledge. Lavinia did not go to the law school. So she had to show up in front of a judge. This is Judge Harmon Conger in Rock County, Wisconsin. Okay. And convince Judge Conger that she could practice law. However, Pliny Norcross, after he's like, "I am moving that Miss Goodall be accepted to the bar of Rock County," which would allow her to practice in all the circuit courts. They had reciprocity. If you were admitted in front of one county circuit court, you were admitted in front of all of them. Okay? Judge Conger's like, "A woman in my courtroom? Is she a harlot?"
Oh my God.
Actually, no. Judge Conger's like, "There's no precedent for this in Wisconsin. So I'm probably going to reject her application to the bar unless you can find me precedent for admitting a woman to the practice of law."
Oh my God. Right?
So Pliny.
Like, knowing that that's not a possibility.
Yeah. So Pliny's out there. There are Pliny's out there. And he tells her, "It's really likely that Judge Conger is going to reject your application. It's very likely he's not going to let you practice law unless you can find some support for it."
Okay.
And, of course, you got to imagine Lavinia is sitting here. Because, like, Lavinia's not the 1870s stay-at-home, calm, neat woman. Like, you all can't see, but I'm going to show Alkali a picture of Lavinia.
Yeah.
Lavinia looks kind of badass. I want to be clear on this. Like, Lavinia is outspoken. She comes from a family that has encouraged her to be outspoken. She has spoken out on slavery. She has spoken out on temperance. She has spoken out on equal rights at a time period when it was uncommon for women to practice law. She goes, "You know what? I'm going to go practice law." When no attorney would tutor her, she's like, "I'm going to teach myself the law." When she found someone to tutor her, that attorney's sitting here saying, "You already know it. Let's go ahead and get you in front of the bar." So this judge says, "Unless you find precedent, you're not going to be a lawyer in the circuit courts of Wisconsin." What does Lavinia do?
"Well, they're going to be looking for precedent, so you've had some pretty crazy cases. I'm going to go." They go back to our favorite, which is church law, and find a female lawyer there in the 1700s. Church law. We haven't done a church law thing in a while.
Lavinia tracks down every female lawyer that she can find in the country.
Oh, my God.
And has them write letters of support that are then presented to Judge Conger.
Oh, I love this.
For the precedent that women have served honorably and competently as attorneys in other states, Judge Conger reads the letters and is like, "Oh, shit. If I say no, the Women's Lawyer Convention of America will kill me. She's admitted to practice. Right? She is admitted to practice. And not only that,
hell yeah.
She's admitted to practice, and she does really well. Like, ends up representing women's suffrage groups. She ends up representing temperance unions, women in divorces, which divorces then were just amazingly hard to get. Like, the law would not let you just say, yeah, I think I'm done with this marriage. You had to, like, prove abuse and shit like that against husbands who 9 times out of 10 did not want to get divorced. So they fought that a lot of times. And she did all of this either pro bono or for low pay in most circumstances. All in front of the circuit courts.
She is awesome.
And it gets better. Because in 1879, she's present when another woman decides, I want to be a lawyer. Angie King. She is present when Angie King is being examined by the judge for admission to the practice of law. And she is so impressed that, like, by the end of the month, and I know it's by the end of the month because Angie King's examination was in 1879. On January 28th, 1879, Lavinia Goodall and Angie King form a law partnership, awesome. Becoming only the third all-female law firm in the United States of America.
I love Wisconsin. This is awesome. Okay.
So, Lavinia Goodall brings this lawsuit in, 1875 on behalf of a temperance union. Okay. All right. The temperance union ends up losing, and it gets appealed to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Right? But here's the problem. Right now, where I am, in most states too, actually in all the states now, when you're admitted to the practice of law, you're admitted before all the states of the court. All the courts of the state, not all the states of the court. That's the first one makes no fucking sense. Then that's not the case. Like, when I got admitted, I was admitted to the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania Bar, which entitles me to practice in front of all courts in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. When Lavinia was admitted, she wasn't admitted to the Supreme Court. She was admitted to the Circuit Court of Rock County, Wisconsin, which entitled her to practice in all the circuit courts in Wisconsin. So in order to represent somebody in front of the Supreme Court, she had to be admitted to the practice of the Wisconsin Supreme Court's bar. Now, there was a law in place that basically said anybody who graduates a law school in Wisconsin can be admitted to these, will be admitted to the Supreme Court bar and the bar of all courts of the state of Wisconsin. And if anyone is admitted to the practice of any circuit court in Wisconsin, he shall be admitted to the practice of the Supreme Court upon application. All right?
All right.
So Lavinia, in this case, she's got no time on this. So she has somebody else represented that client. But before she did that, she tried to get admitted to the Supreme Court of Wisconsin. She files a petition thinking, oh, shit, I've got a client going to the Supreme Court. Yeah, I don't have time to get the admission. I'll have this other guy handle that case because he's already got an admission. But I've got a petition to be admitted to the Supreme Court of Wisconsin so that I don't have to do that in the future. I can keep representing my client, right? Let's take a brief aside.
Oh, no. What did you find
out? We are in 1875 when that happens, when Lavinia files her petition to the Supreme Court of Wisconsin for admission. It is the summer of 1875. Okay? Edward George Ryan.
Oh, God.
Edward George Ryan is an Irish immigrant. He comes to New York in 1830. He becomes a U.S. citizen. He is admitted to the bar of New York. He's a lawyer in New York. In 1842, after his first marriage to Mary Graham ends, he actually went from New York to Chicago first.
It's a good move. Yeah. It's nice there.
Yeah, he practices law. He adds a newspaper. He's working as a city attorney in Chicago. He marries his first wife, Mary Graham. 1842, he moves to Racine, Wisconsin. At that point, the Wisconsin Territory, where he continues to act as a lawyer. He's actually in the first Constitutional Convention of Wisconsin in 1846. This is one of the guys who helped write the very first Wisconsin Constitution after it became a state. That very first Constitution is then submitted to the voters for ratification, and it's just roundly fucking rejected. They've got no, and I'd like to, you're gonna understand, like, I think one of them may be like, oh, Eddie Ryan? Yeah, fuck that guy. He had something to do with this? No. No, we're done.
God.
So, he is a Democrat in 1846. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we all know what that means. Democrat in 1846 is a, like, yeah, it's a 2024 MAGA Republican. That's what a Democrat in 1846 was. They were the pro-slavery, small government, fuck local governments, all that stuff. That's what they were at that point. That they were the bad guys. They were the baddies, okay? So he's a Democrat there. He's practicing law. He's been involved in all this stuff. He's actually kind of, like, well-known. He's a bit of a community leader at that point. What the fuck was wrong with you all? 1847, his wife dies. Mary dies. Okay.
Did he shoot her in the dick?
No, he did not. He moves to Milwaukee. He is in 1853. Yeah, like, he's involved in a lot of notable cases in Wisconsin history. In 1843, Edward Ryan was the prosecuting attorney in the impeachment of Wisconsin Circuit Court Judge Levi Hubbell in relation to corruption charges.
Okay.
And, you know, that sounds really good, right?
Yeah.
Leroy Hubbell was not a Democrat and had apparently pissed off Edward Ryan at some point, because everybody who watched the prosecution is like, no, this is personal. This has nothing to do with corruption. Like, he just does not like this judge.
The further back in time you go with these stories, I start to realize that being a lawyer in this time period is basically just high school recess.
Yeah,
somehow.
Like, no, it really is kind of the same fucking
thing.
If
you
now.
All went out there with all the assholes you knew in high school, that's exactly how the law worked pre-1900.
1854, 1855, he is a prosecutor for the United States. Yeah. He was the United States prosecutor in the case of Abelman v. Booth. Like, three people in the room who have read Wisconsin history know what that case is. In the 1850s, the Fugitive Slave Act was created for the return of slaves who have escaped, mandating the return of slaves who have escaped slavery into a free territory, which Wisconsin was. There's an abolitionist by the name of Sherman Booth. Sherman Booth sheltered and helped freed slaves leave the country. Sherman Booth is arrested and is prosecuted in the case of Abelman v. Booth. Edward Ryan goes, I want to prosecute him. Edward Ryan, I just want to make this clear, was not a federal prosecutor. He volunteered to prosecute Sherman Booth.
Oh my God.
Okay. So what happens is it actually ends up, the prosecution ends up going all the way to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Ryan wins the case at trial. It goes to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. There's a justice on the Wisconsin Supreme Court named Byron Payne. Byron Payne is a Republican, does not agree with the Fugitive Slave Act, and essentially says, you know what? The Fugitive Slave Act is unconstitutional in Wisconsin, and we will not enforce it. Keep this in mind, Byron Payne, okay? That case, by the way, Abelman v. Booth, went to the United States Supreme Court. The Supreme Court of the United States overturned it. It actually is what we call a keystone case for the concept that states don't have the power to nullify a federal law. They can't just say that law is unconstitutional within our thing. So it's a horrible case, but good precedent on it, to be honest, to some extent, because there's some federal laws that you really don't want Florida saying, yeah, that doesn't apply here anymore.
And they've tried.
And by the way, my background, other than law, for listeners, for everybody in the room, is history. And the area I studied included what they called the nullification crisis, where a bunch of southern states tried to nullify federal laws, too. So, Booth, though, it's just to be clear, Booth did end up being pardoned by James Buchanan. President Buchanan's like, okay, well, it's a federal law, so I can pardon him, and ends up pardoning Booth. I assume that only made Ryan meaner. Because, you read through the stuff, and it's like every description from any source about Edward Ryan is he's an asshole, he's bad-tempered, no one likes him. Okay.
I think that's a good description for this ass.
1855, he gets election results thrown out. A governor, in return, appoints him to fill a vacancy on the Wisconsin Supreme Court. In 1874, after Luther S. Dixon resigns, and now Edward Ryan is the Chief Justice of the Wisconsin Supreme Court in 1874, with Byron Payne, the guy who's like, yeah, no, fuck you, Eddie, on the court with him.
Oh, my God.
So this is the gentleman who's there. By the way, in the meantime, during all this, Ryan marries again in 1850. 1872, Ryan's second wife, Carolyn Willard, is like, yeah, you're a bad-tempered, angry asshole, and we are leaving you. Takes the kids, leaves him. All right. Then, in 1875, Lavinia Goodall applies for admission to the Supreme Court of Wisconsin.
Oh, fuck. Okay.
Let me ask a question, just right off the bat before we go any further. Do you think she won?
I'm got to have to start off with absolutely not. This guy seems like a true asshole.
The case is in re the application of Miss Lavinia Goodall. It is reported at 39 Wisconsin Reporter 232 from 1876. The judge who wrote the unanimous opinion of the Wisconsin Supreme Court is Chief Justice Edward Ryan. Ryan starts with, and I'm just going to quote, in courts proceeding according to the course of the common law, a bar is almost as essential as the bench. And a good bar may be said to be a necessity to a good court. This is not always understood, perhaps not fully, by the bar itself. On the bench, the lesson is soon learned that the facility and accuracy of judicial labor are largely dependent on the learning and ability of the bar. And it well becomes every court to be careful of its bar and jealous of the rule of admission to it, with the view of fostering in it the highest order of professional excellence.
Well, then what the hell is he doing there?
Yeah. So, if you don't read the rest of the opinion, this could be a really good prefatory clause, and that is why we are happy to admit Miss Lavinia Goodall to the practice of law before the Supreme Court of Wisconsin.
Yeah, but I've been listening to you, and I know that's not where this is going.
He then says, the Constitution makes no provision for the requirements of the entry to the bar, does not say who gets to determine who can be admitted to the bar. Now, remember I said earlier that the law in Wisconsin at that point was everybody who graduates from the University of Wisconsin's law school is automatically admitted to practice before the courts of Wisconsin, and anybody who is admitted before the circuit courts upon application, he shall receive admission.
Okay.
Okay. Okay.
Do so not, hold on.
There is, hold on. No, we'll get to it.
Oh, I know where this is going! Oh.
So Judge Ryan goes through, and there are like three or four paragraphs here where he basically says the legislature shouldn't be allowed to tell us who we admit to the bar. They have no constitutional authority to tell us that. We are a separate and independent branch of the government. We get to control who practices in front of us. So the legislature shouldn't have that power. We question whether or not their laws directing who should be admitted to the practice of law before us are appropriate, are even enforceable. He then says, but when they make a good reason, whether they have the power or not, we'll happily defer to it. We'll happily defer to what they wrote. Okay? So he's basically,
once they agree with us, we'll be fine with it.
But what he's basically saying is, I question whether the legislature can tell me who to admit to the bar.
Yeah.
Which is, to be honest, kind of a valid argument for the separation of powers. Your judiciary is supposed to be a separate branch. It should not be fully beholden on your legislature or your executive. That's the whole idea. Checks and balances.
That kind of stops when the rule is, no, if I can't shoot him in the dick, that can't be a lawyer. That's really not the right way to do this.
Then he's saying, however, we don't want to start this constitutional crisis right now. Like, that's what he's saying, by the way. He's like, that language when he's like, it is our pleasure. Yeah, in the meantime, it is a pleasure to defer to all reasonable statutes on the subject. So we will decide this motion on the present statutes without passing on their binding force. That's saying, like, first of all, fuckers, you don't get to tell us who's going to practice law. Yeah. We make that decision. Secondly, we really don't want to pick this fight right now. So despite me spending four paragraphs telling you you're assholes and you can't tell me what to do, we're going to do what you tell us to do based on... All right. He then goes in and says... This is the first application for admission of a female to the bar of this court, and it is just matter for congratulation that it is made in favor of a lady whose character raises no personal objection. Something perhaps not always to be looked for in women who forsake the ways of their sex for the ways of ours.
Oh!
What the fuck?
Oh, I can't wait for somebody to shoot him.
So he goes in and he's like, the statute about this is for admission to the bar and all these things. And then he goes into it, and, you know, these six sections give a rule to the circuit courts. They avoid giving any rule to this court, which means admission before this court is in discretion of this court. And, you know, this is perhaps just sufficient. We get to say yes or no. The statute itself isn't really specific about our court. It's we get to say who gets to be admitted. But Miss Goodall and her counsel here have taken the novel position that the statute itself calls for broader interpretation. Okay? What was Miss Goodall's argument? First of all, why does the statute bar her admission? There's a statute there. It says all graduates of our law school are admitted to our courts, and anybody with an admission to circuit court, he shall be, upon application, made a member of the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Why does the statute bar admission?
I am so scared because I know how your lawyer shit works. Is it literally because the word he is
he,
in there?
The word he
suck.
Is in the statute.
You suck! Lawyers, all you lawyers listening here, all you lawyers from the 1800s listening to this show, you suck.
So what's the response to that? The word he's right there. They come in and they say, Lavinia Goodall and her attorney, who is, by the way, her attorney, is like the assistant attorney general for Wisconsin. Like, he's not a small guy. Like, and this wasn't at a time when the attorney general's office had like 100 lawyers. This is a time when the attorney general's office had like 10 guys. So being an assistant attorney general was a big deal. And he, like, when Lavinia's like, hey, would you argue this case for me? He's like, yes, definitely. Like, she's very well respected in the legal community. Other lawyers know and like Lavinia Goodall. They describe her as intelligent. They describe her as good-natured. They describe her as driven, a wonderful advocate. It is the pleasure of him to do that. The response to the argument is, okay, yes, it says he, but you're forgetting the rules of construction. Because while a court, when determining statutes, is supposed to look at what does the statute say, there are rules of construction and interpretation. And one of them, probably the biggest one of them, is unless otherwise specified, if a statute says the singular, it can mean the plural as well.
Okay.
And if it uses a gendered pronoun, that applies to all genders. He does not mean she is necessarily excluded, and vice versa.
Oh, your law was woke for a second. Well done.
Otherwise, if you had like a murder statute and it said he shall be convicted of murder in the first degree, it'd be like women can't commit murder.
And that's why she shot him in the face.
Lavinia goes on and says, in addition, remember that other statute. Anyone who graduates from our law schools shall be admitted to practice in front of all of our courts. Right?
Okay.
Wisconsin, just prior to 1876 and 1867, had made an act that said anyone of any gender can be admitted to our universities in all of their departments. You can't bar admission based on gender. Slightly after that, the University of Wisconsin established a law school, meaning at that time, when they established the law school based on the 1867 law, women could be admitted to the law school of the University of Wisconsin, and in fact could not be denied entry. And because they were now law school graduates, were automatically admitted to the bar.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay.
All right.
Excellent.
That's wonderful. Except the judge here is like, you know what? No, that's not what they meant. He's like, first of all, the 1867 law obviously exempts women from some departments because it says they're admitted to all departments except those involving military instruction. So there's obviously a caveat there. And second, at the time they wrote the law, they could not have intended for it to apply to women for the law school because there was no law school. Because the second rule of construction, this is a real rule of construction. If you can't figure out from the meaning of the statute what it says, you can look at the legislative intent. What did the legislature intend when they wrote that law? So Ryan's like, well, the legislature couldn't have intended for this to allow women to be admitted to the practice of law because we didn't have a law school when they wrote that. And they already had determined that there were departments that women couldn't study at the University of Wisconsin. So if they wrote that law after the law school had been established,
they would have said except military instruction and law.
Women can't be law. You're like the legislature in Wisconsin would have been like, yeah, they can't be soldiers and they can't be lawyers. Those are the only fucking two.
Oh my God.
That's his response. But the argument that Lavinia's lawyer is making is like really good. I mean, think about it. It's like, you know, there's rules of construction. They obviously would apply here. And there's another law out there that obviously says women can be admitted, and they're stringing together all these legal sites. I mean, that's a solid argument, right?
Yeah.
Right? By the way, you gotta love Lavinia Goodall and her lawyer for this, because after he finishes arguing the case to the Supreme Court, because Lavinia can't fucking talk. Like, that's the rule. She can be there, but she can't talk. She's not admitted to the bar. She doesn't get to address the court. He says, as he finishes his argument, I would like the court to know that my brief and argument today are not mine. They were written by Miss Goodall.
Oh, that's so good! That is so good!
So they come into that, and it's like, so obviously the legislature didn't mean women should be admitted. There's no statutory authority in this state for women to be admitted. And once again, Ryan, and with all the respect and sympathy for this lady, which all men owe to all good women, we cannot regret that we deny her entry to the practice of law. We cannot but think the common law wise in excluding women from the profession. The profession enters largely into the well-being of society, and to be honorably filled and safely to society exacts the devotion of life.
What?
If that pisses you off, wait.
This gets worse?
The law of nature.
Oh!
Destines and qualifies the female sex for the bearing and nurture of the children of our race.
Oh! Oh!
And for the custody of the homes of the world and their maintenance in love and honor. It is all lifelong callings of women, inconsistent with these radical and sacred duties of their sex, as is the profession of law, are departures from the order of nature, and when voluntary, treason against it.
Whoa!
Jesus. Hey. Hold on! That's like a 1 to 100.
I want to throw a tomato at this guy.
We're working on the time machine. I got this one. I got this.
There are many employments in life not unfit for the female character. The profession of law is surely not one of these. The peculiar qualities of womanhood, its gently graces, its quick sensibility, its tender susceptibility, its purity, its delicacy, its emotional impulses, its subordination of hard reason to sympathetic feeling, are surely not qualifications for forensic strife. Nature has tempered woman as little for the judicial conflicts of the courtroom as for the physical conflicts of the battlefield. Womanhood is molded for gentler and better things, and it is not the saints of the world who chiefly give employment to our profession. It has essentially and habitually to do with all that is selfish and malicious, knavish and criminal, coarse and brutal, repulsive and obscene in human life. It would be revolting to all female sense of innocence and sanctity of their sex, shocking to man's reverence for womanhood and faith in women, on which hinge all the better affections and humanities of life, that women should be permitted to mix professionally in all the nastiness of the world which finds its way into the courts, all the unclean issues, all the collateral questions of sodomy, incest, rape, seduction, fornication, adultery, pregnancy, bastardy, illegitimacy, prostitution, lascivious cohabitation, abortion, infanticide, obscene publications, libel and slander of sex, impotence, divorce, all the nameless catalog of indecencies. Motherfucker, you just named them all. By the way, I want to point out that like 3/4 of what he mentions, like, women should not have to deal with this, or crimes against women.
Yeah.
Like, they shouldn't have to deal with it unless, you know, you're my ex-wife, that bitch who took my kids.
Holy shit, man.
It's like, he's like, we hold women in too much reverence to put to them this unseemly duty.
I'm just shocked that this asshole owns a thesaurus, because that's obviously what's going on here. This is about the worst Twitter post I've ever seen. I think that's...
It's better. Because
there's no bad... What? What?
He actually says, like, when counsel is arguing for this lady, like, he heard the lawyer say, like, she wrote all this, and he's like, yeah, no, she fucking did. Like, Edward Ryan's a prick. I'm just letting you know. He's a prick. Like,
wow.
if you hadn't picked up on it already, you know. But he's like, you know, it would be reductio ad absurdum, reducing it to absurdity to say women can be lawyers, as absurd as, and I am not shitting you, this is the analogy he made, asking women to vote. Because those womanly graces mean that they shouldn't have to bother themselves with thinking about politics. He actually goes forward and is like, if we apply this to women being admitted to the practice of law, it means that we have to apply it to women voting. And that's ridiculous. Why our Constitution says only white males may vote.
All right, forget about the time machine for the tomato. We're about to introduce them to the hand grenade.
Yeah.
Holy shit, man.
He says, if these things, if as counsel threatened, these things are to come, we will take no voluntary part in bringing them about. They deny her application for practice before the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Now, you may have missed it. It was a unanimous decision. Edward Ryan's a prick. He's the one who wrote this opinion. But the decision to deny her application was unanimous. And why was it unanimous?
Did he have that much control over the Supreme Court?
Absolutely not. In fact, Byron Payne is sitting on the court at that time.
What?
Who we all know he's not fond of. It is because of the power battle between the legislature and the court in determining the admission of law.
Oh my God.
For the rest of the justices, not Edward Ryan. Edward Ryan's a prick. We'll get to that again here in a second. But for the rest of them, it is, you think you can tell us who to admit to the court? Well, if you don't tell us correctly, we're going to use the exact words you wrote, you pricks. You don't get to tell us what to do.
So they weren't even voting on her admittance. They were voting on their own power.
They were voting on their own power versus the legislature. It's kind of that thing of malicious compliance. Yep. If you tell me to do X, I'm going to do exactly X. I don't care what you meant. You should have told me better. For the rest of the justices, that's what it is. And how do we know that's what it is?
Did they also write paragraphs of nonsense?
No.
What?
Because after being denied entry, Lavinia Goodall doesn't give up. Instead, Lavinia Goodall lobbies the legislature. And in 1877, the Wisconsin legislature puts into effect a law that says nobody may be denied admission to any Wisconsin court on the basis of gender.
Yes!
And how do we know that that was really a separation of power snipe fest for every judge but Chief Justice Ryan? Because in 1878, Lavinia Goodall petitions for admission to the Wisconsin Supreme Court again, as soon as the law is effective. And in 1879, Justice Cole of the Wisconsin Supreme Court, in the case N. Ray, application of Goodall, 49 Wisconsin 693, 1880, issues the ruling. And the ruling is, first, we do not agree that the legislature has the power to tell us who we must admit. We agree with Chief Justice Ryan the last time this came over on that. However, as Chief Justice Ryan said 2 years ago, it is our pleasure to defer to the legislature when their statement is reasonable and for the good order and practice of law and benefits the court and the bar. So it is our pleasure with the rewritten law to grant Ms. Goodall's application to practice before the Wisconsin Supreme Court.
That's fantastic.
And the entirety of the Wisconsin Supreme Court agreed, with the exception of Chief Justice Edward Ryan. He is the only dissenting judge. Like when it says it, by the court so ordered, Ryan, Chief Justice, dissenting.
Oh, now, to be a tomato portal on that wall.
That's the happy ending. Lavinia Goodall is admitted to the practice of the Wisconsin Supreme Court. She is the first woman to practice law, be admitted to the practice of law in Wisconsin in general. She is the first woman to practice law in front, or to be admitted to the practice of law in front of the Wisconsin Supreme Court. She has paved the way. She has had the legislature rewrite the law itself so that no woman can be denied the right to practice law on the basis of their gender. Lavinia Goodall, shortly after this decision is entered, gets sick. In January of 1880, she comes to Milwaukee. She has had health problems for the last couple years. She goes to Dr. Hansen's Turkish Bath on Sycamore Avenue, which is, you know, it's kind of a rest area. It's to make you better. It's not like a miracle cure, but it's like, you know, we focus on relaxing your mind, relaxing your body. Some people get better from having that stress lifted, some people don't. After a couple months there, it becomes obvious she's not getting better. A old family friend lives less than a block away from the Turkish Bath. The old family friend says, it's very clear she's towards the end of her life at that point. The old friend says, hey, come over to my house. She goes to that friend's house at 4th and Sycamore, where on March 3rd, 1880, Lavinia Goodall, shortly after being admitted to practice before the Supreme Court of Wisconsin, passes away from her illnesses. And you all can't see it, but I'll show Alkali that's her death certificate right there. At 132 4th Street near Sycamore in Milwaukee.
Sycamore?
Sycamore, okay. So, I hear all of you right now, what happened to Chief Justice Ryan? Like, Lavinia dies. What happens to Chief Justice Ryan? October of 1880, that fucker dies too. And you know what? No, I think it's a little poetic because, like, Lavinia had her victory, went out on top right there.
Yeah.
Right, like, right there. She changes the game. Edward Ryan, that racist, misogynistic fuck, has to live for 7 months angry. And then he dies alone and divorced in his house in Madison, Wisconsin. Okay? There's a coda to this story. Lavinia dies at 4th and Sycamore. Okay?
Holy shit.
132 4th Street, less than a block away from the Turkish Bath at like 451 Sycamore. None of these buildings are still here anymore. In 1930, the city of Milwaukee, to comply with an ordinance regarding the naming of streets, renamed and renumbered a lot of streets. Okay? And where the name on one side of the river was different from the name of the street on the other side of the river, they changed the names to match on both sides of the river. The western side of the river was where Sycamore Street was. Okay? The eastern side of the river was where Michigan Street was. They're the same street. So, in 1930, the name of Sycamore was changed to Michigan.
Holy
132
shit,
4th Street near Sycamore.
Holy shit. How did you find
132 4th Street near Sycamore is now a block that is between Michigan Street and what used to be Spring Street and is now Wisconsin on 4th. Folks, we are sitting in 509 5th Street between Michigan and Wisconsin. If you walk out the front door of this hotel on 5th Street and look across the street, there is a parking lot under construction. In that parking lot is the house where Lavinia Goodall, the first female lawyer in the history of Wisconsin and the first lawyer to practice before the Wisconsin Supreme Court, female lawyer to practice, the owner of the third law firm ran by women in this country, a pioneer. That parking lot is the site of the house where Lavinia Goodall died on March 3rd,
1880. Holy shit. good case.
For everybody listening at home, Alkali is crying.
Fuck off.
We got to burn this.
Holy shit.
Man. That is the cases of In Re application of Miss Lavinia Goodall. And this has been Boozy's Legal Funhouse. I am your host, the Boozy Badger. With me, as always, is our certified legal layman.
I am a hot mess.
Holy thank you shit. So much. And thank you very much, First Squared, for letting me do this one live. We love you all. Have a wonderful rest of your convention, and we'll see you next time.
Dude. Dude.